going to talk about the eye and the spirit and try to develop the idea that there is a new task for Christians in these days of understanding Christianity among the religions of the world. Now, that may not be exactly a brand new task for these days, but it's a task that at least in its newness has an increasing urgency about it. I'd like to develop that under the sacred images that make the world. Now, you may not believe that. 20th century people of our stripe probably don't believe that, people in the developed world. But if I were to say to you Christians, if I were to read to you Christians a sentence, perhaps this will illustrate it. Faith, we live in the faith in the promise made to a thief. What have I just said to you? What's the referent and what have I just said to you? We live by faith in the promise made to a thief. Okay, you see, there's an image here, implicit just in those few words, the cross, the crucifixion, and you got the promise of glory, right? I want to maintain that it is that kind of meaning drawn from these kinds of images that is a glue that holds the world together, at least as well as it is holding together these days, and that isn't saying a whole hoop and lot. But I'm trying to say to you that there are sacred images which make the world, and I'd like to demonstrate that by a few comments about worldview tonight. And we'll have some time to look at some images tomorrow. I want to talk about iconography, Christian iconography, tomorrow for a while, using one altarpiece mainly, and that's because it comes from the Northern Renaissance, which is my favorite period of painting in the first place. In the second place, the Northern Renaissance painting is marvelously didactic. It is rigorously theological, and you find all sorts of marvelous lessons in the way in which these people put their beautiful compositions together. Says all we need to say in simple and direct terms. And you have to do a lot of this by extension. If I can stimulate you to think further and explore further, that's really what we can do. Because on the final night, Thursday night, there won't be time to show very many pictures, and besides, I don't have very many pictures to show you. We could do a long, long time on iconography of world religions. It would be lots of fun. But I think what I have to try to do is to give you an idea that in reading pictures, you can read that worldview. You can read from those images those things that keep the world together. When we talk about world religions, we're probably talking in the area, as some of them would suggest, the area of comparative religion would suggest itself to some of you. Comparative religions, one 19th century cynic has said, makes people comparatively religious. And that's probably true of the way in which a lot of comparative religion, world religions, were treated. But I want to suggest to you there's a lot more seriousness in them today. Let me just run through eight questions that might be underneath our first layer of understanding here. Are all religions aiming at the same goal? Are all religions only partly true? Could the Christian ecumenical movement possibly contain other participants besides Christians? Are all the gods the same as the God we worship? Won't God eventually save everyone who sincerely believes? Is religion concerned primarily with a world beyond this life? Is the United States of America superior because we are a Christian nation? Is there anything in other religions which Christianity would be better off for having or for knowing? I don't know how you answered those questions mentally, but there is something in all of them. Are all religions aiming at the same goal? in part they are. I hope we can show that. Are all religions only partly true? Well, it depends a lot. I think that probably Christians would be very rigorous in the way they want to answer that question. Could the Christian ecumenical movement possibly include others than Christians? It already does. Are all the gods the same as the God we worship? That's one that's very hard for us to answer, except in speculative terms, and I think Christians would say no to that. Won't God eventually save everyone who sincerely believes? There are more insincere believers in the Western world than there are other places in religion. Is religion concerned primarily with the world beyond this life? Some are. Is the USA superior because we are a Christian nation? There's a certain kind of religion that says absolutely that's true. It happens to be civil religion. Is there anything in other religions which Christianity would be better off for having or for knowing? A contemplative mood, perhaps? More diligent faithfulness, like you find in Islam? A greater zeal, like you find in fundamentalistic Islam? Well, those questions are just there to get you juiced up a little bit, to get you started thinking about some of these issues, which are not just necessarily cut and dried. You know, we can be very parochial in our approach to religion. The first thing I want to say is that we are all religious beings. Human beings are religious. All people are. Would you read Ecclesiastes 10:3-10-15 for us, please?
I have seen the business that God has given to the sons of men to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's mind, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. Also, that it is God's gift to man that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. I know that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has made it so, in order that men should fear before him.
Put eternity in our minds in a way that we are never going to be able to unscrew it all. There is still a mystery, but we have been given that kind of mystery. Our choice is not whether or not to be religious, but rather the choice is which religion we're going to follow. And people all over the world have different views of what that whole destiny is and is about. Religion has probably more definitions than verses in the Bible, I expect. It's one of those abstractions that probably you come at more by indirection than in direct fashion. By an eminent historian, a Christian historian, whose majestic system of civilizations makes him one of the greatest of the 20th century, Arnold Toynbee says that religion is the authoritative revelation of truth about ultimate reality. And I think that probably in that you have several terms that need to be underscored. One of them is revelation, one of them is truth, and one of them is reality. Let's start with reality, truth, and revelation. We're going to try to look for some commonalities, but in thinking of sacred images and looking at iconography, we probably are dealing with those kinds of images which have some reality in their basis. That is, painting deals with, and we'll look at this tomorrow, the Virgin Mary. And you can recognize the Virgin Mary as a female child with a baby, and that whole thing is in Revelation, and then the artist is trying to say something about the meaning of that revelation based on that reality, bringing that reality forward. The authoritative revelation of truth about ultimate reality, not just any old reality, but that which is final reality, the reality that is the ground and the foundation of everything. That's what religion is trying to get at. And our authoritative reality is found in the creed, I'd maintain. That's the way Christians put the world together. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. I wish I could say the modern one, but I haven't learned that yet. That is our worldview. And if you want an expansion of your worldview, go back and look at Luther's explanation to the three articles of the Creed in the Small Catechism. I propose to you that that's a worldview that's shared by something like 80 million people around the world, because that's about the number of Lutherans for whom that catechism is a basic confession, and that explanation is the kind of thing that is involved in education. The explanation to the creed is our worldview. Now, I don't know whether anybody wants to debate that. We can. But I think what that says is the way we believe the world is put together, the way we believe the world functions, and the way we believe the world is going to end, and what happens to us in very personal terms in between, and defining the church, and forgiveness, and a lot of other things besides. That's a worldview. That's the way we put the world together. Now, whether we have other worldviews that compete with that, Christian friends, or not, is something else again. Because there are ways in which one can hold that as an official worldview on Sunday morning and have a different worldview the rest of the week, a worldview that has a lot to do with an old and nasty kind of religion, which we'll get to later on. But this leads me to say about Lutherans that there are three strands of possibility in our piety and in our life together. And you ought to notice these, because it makes a lot of difference to our discussion and the comfort of any discussion of theology. They are these: orthodoxy, O-R-T-H-O, orthodoxy, pietism, P-I-E-T-I-S-M, and critical awareness. I put them down on a board because we're going to be working in this with one, and that's the critical awareness strand. These belong to Sidney Ahlstrom, not to me, a great Lutheran historian from Yale. Ahlstrom says that in American piety, American Lutheranism, you can find these three strands and find them very clearly. Orthodoxy, that means getting it just right. That means being sure that the words of the creed all have the right content, all have the right nuance, because at an extreme point, this orthodoxy, people are saved by their theology, whether they've got it right or not. Orthodoxy looks for cerebral truth. It looks for accuracy. It's very much interested in theology. It's very much interested in propositional theology, certain kinds of theology. Pietism is something else again. That's a religion of the heart, not of the head. That's one that is very open-hearted, very outgoing, very Holden Village-ish, I think, in many respects. That one is interested in doing good works. It tends to be a little emotional, not so cerebral, in contrast to orthodoxy. It is typically Scandinavian, whereas orthodoxy tends to be more Germanic in our traditions in this country. It really wants to preserve all the old traditions. In the Norwegian piety out of which I come, people will vote for a scoundrel because he seems to be a good man, or somebody who's very dumb because he's a good man, kind of a warm-heartedness about that. The critical awareness strand, however, has to do with our heritage. It has to do with our Lutheran dedication to college education, parochial education. It has to do with that Reformation task in the first place raised the question of the gospel in chains. It's the critical awareness that represents our freedom. the necessity of independent thought, the necessity of criticism of tradition. And it's that critical awareness, you see, that we have to get pushed up here into operative position if we're going to look at world religions. If you're going to look at world religions, you see, and have some sympathy for the kinds of things we're talking about, you're not so much involved in imagination as we were last week, as you are saying, well, we can be independent a little bit of our orthodoxy for a while, although that'll come in. We can understand some things because of the religious feelings and emotions of some folks, if we will say, well, there are some possibilities besides Christian options. But be assured that it's not un-Lutheran to take a critical look at the apparatus of religion, ours or somebody else's. You aren't going to get very far if orthodoxy or piety become the circumference of your understanding of religion. I'm trying to say, let's not be too parochial here. Let's let the question expand as far as the world goes, and see what it tells us. So the question, I guess, next is, why do we care about world religion? Why in the first place do we care about world religions? Why in this time, in this period of time, are religions, is this inquiry important? Well, there are some religious reasons, some Christian religious reasons for that. Somebody read that passage in 1 Timothy, please, 2:1-7.
First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for all men, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life, godly and respectful in every way. This is good, and it is acceptable in all the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved, to come to the knowledge of truth. For there is one God, and there is one mediator between God and men, the man Jesus Christ, who gave himself as a ransom for all, the testimony to which was bore at the proper time. For this I was appointed a preacher and an apostle. I am telling the truth, I am not lying, a teacher of the Gentiles in faith and truth.
Thank you. What that says is that it is the desire of the Savior that everybody in the world, all people of all time, should be saved and should know the Savior. That's a Christian claim. It comes out of Jewish consciousness, because you notice the reference to the Gentiles there. That salvation is available to all people. That's a missionary nerve, in other words, like the Great Commission in Matthew, that all the world should know. All right, that's kind of a reason for our being concerned about world religion, because the Christian religion isn't the only one resident in the world. All should be saved and come to the knowledge of Christ. There is besides that universal desire of God, if we can put it that way, we know about a universal desire of God, there is a universal longing of human beings for meaning, to recover loss. St. Augustine's famous quotation, "Our hearts are restless until they rest in thee." It's another kind of religious reason that goes to personal motivation, that business of looking for meaning. And then there is such a thing as a revival of world religion these days. And that's probably one of the most striking things that's happening. People are moving all over the world these days, and it's making all sorts of changes. Islam is the third largest religion now in the United States of America. Did you know that? Christianity is soon going to be predominant in the southern hemisphere of the world, not the northern hemisphere anymore. Did you know that? It won't take long. You've noticed the effects in Iran of a renewed zeal in fundamentalistic Islam. Those of you who think we ought to be real zealous about religious, look at the Ayatollah Khomeini. Religion makes all sorts of news these days, but what's happening is that there is a revival in world religions. In O'Hare Airport and lots of other airports and lots of other places, you can see the saffron robes of the Hare Krishna people, the Buddhists of the West. Whatever you think about all that, I'm saying to you, there are the evidences. It's all around. There is a revival going on, a religious revival going on in the world, and some of these world religions, especially Islam and Buddhism, are fermenting. There are some personal reasons too, I think, for doing this, paying attention. Personal reasons, the search for meaning in religious experience. A lot of people are involved in cults. We're not going to talk about cults, but down here in Oregon, that little town where the Maharaja has taken over, you find people, American people, solid citizens, who have been looking for exotic ways of fulfilling human potential, and they've joined that kind of thing. There's an interest in spirituality, and when people begin to be interested in that interior life and its spirituality, one of the first things they've got to notice is that there is more than one spirituality. There are spiritualities, lots of them. And some of those inner spiritualities, when it comes to meditation, the contemplative life, and so on, come really very strongly through Eastern religions. Christianity is an activist, an ethical religion. Besides that, in the third place, in personal reasons, there are many Christians today who travel the world, who participate in an industrial business, oikoumene, scientific, artistic, all sorts of universal nation-transcending activity. I teach an adult class in St. Charles, and in that adult class, there's an architect from Perkins and Will, a firm in Chicago, who builds hospitals and schools, and they build them all around the world. Dewey Schultz is an architect from Harvard, and he's one who insisted that we look at world religions because, he said, I go to build, but I go to build an organized space in ways that are meaningful to a different culture than mine, and I've become aware that those cultures are all motivated by religion, much more so than I am, and I need to know something about the religion these people hold in order to be able to do something significant for them architecturally. And he's not just enclosing space. And a Quonset hut would do. But that's not what Perkins and Will does, because there are other things that are involved in building buildings. In that same class is a coach for the U.S. Olympic kayak people. He's in Yugoslavia and all around the world in between Olympic Games. One of our good friends is an electronics engineer, president of a firm, and managing a firm in Texas now. He travels to China, and he spends 3 or 4 weeks there on business. Regularly. China is new. Japan was the last episode. Jim Griffin, the husband of my wife, my secretary, is a scientist at Fermilab. Jim is one of these people who works on these high energy accelerators. He travels to Russia, spends a lot of time in Russia, a lot of time in Europe, a lot of time in China. You can be invited any place in the world. I'm saying to you that there are people that you know, some of you, participate in a transnational oikoumene, in a worldwide kind of thing, in business, industry, science, the arts. All sorts of people are traveling. And world religions are involved in that, it seems to me. Then there are public reasons besides, personal and religious reasons. Public reasons. Religion is an active ingredient in world news. Some wise person has said that an educated person, in addition to knowing his European past, has got to know his Asian present. Because so many things are happening in Asia. And we've already referred to Iran. If you think just of world conflicts and how much of religion is associated with world conflicts, the theology of apartheid in South Africa, all that Protestant Catholic hatred that goes on in Ireland. You think of these things, it's not necessarily all religion. There's a lot of politics and a lot of other things involved in those nasty situations. But what I'm trying to say is that in the public press, you will find religious stuff there all the time. Marge Heyer, who's a religion writer for the Washington Post, told a group in New York last fall that to have a religion page in a newspaper trivializes religion. Because on the religion page, you will find that somebody is dedicating an organ and some distinguished organist is coming to play a recital. Or you'll find in the religion page the latest scandal that involves somebody who absconded with church funds or something like that. But religion is much broader. Religion is all over the newspapers if we knew how to look. It's a mooring for public policy in the second place. When that whole Iran business happened, television in Chicago, none of the channels in Chicago knew anything about Islam. They knew nothing about the background, the political background or the religious background of the Ayatollah Khomeini. They knew he'd come from Paris and they knew he'd been a troublemaker for a while. But they had to go to the University of Chicago to find some guy who was a specialist in Islam to try to explain in the 2-minute segment he had what in the world the background of that whole thing was. Now, if it's important enough for CBS or ABC to have put on, I don't know how many, 490-some days of keeping track of the captives, 15 minutes on Nightline, a new program, it would certainly be useful enough for us maybe to have a religion reporter who could give some continuing background on that. But we are woefully ignorant of religion as it affects public policy in the news. Thank you. We're in trouble. I can tell you right now. The last reason, I can't cut that out. I have to tell you what Arnold Toynbee says in a book called Christianity Among the Religions of the World. He's trying to survey what the position of Christianity and other religions is in the setting of the modern world and in the face of the resurgence of another religion, which is an old one and a bad one, our worship of ourselves in the plural, in the shape of collective human power. On one side of the Iron Curtain, this common adversary of all the higher religions takes the form of communism. On the other side, it takes the form of nationalism. At bottom, nationalism and communism are variations of the same perverse theme, man's self-centered worship of himself. That's also a world religion, an old one and a bad one. And what we'll probably do is just see if I can't skip to that. Skip to that by way of the changed world situation. We've already observed this one transnational kind of existence in the crossing of the world of people as they go about daily work. Very soon we'll be getting reports from Budapest about the Lutheran World Federation. And in that meeting of the Lutheran World Federation, in a sense, the whole world will be there. Every continent will be represented, all sorts of languages will be there. We're really up against a changing and changed world situation. When you think back, there was a time when the world was divided into Greeks and barbarians. And another period, there were Jews and Gentiles. The whole world was divided this way. Or the whole world in Luther's day was divided between Christians and Turks. Now there is a discovery that mankind is one, and you can find a celebration of that interdependence in the United Nations, in such books as Robert Mueller, who's secretary for UNESCO, in a book called But Mostly They Taught Me Happiness, I think is a word. His record of Utant and Dag Hammarskjöld and the people who have been Secretaries General of the United Nations, because that's a clue as to what's been happening in the world, the United Nations. Or if you look at it a different way, the challenges of history, the challenges of a new world that have been the changes that have taken place from a Jewish faith in a Hellenistic world, which gave us biblical language of the kind that had been explored in the Bible studies, Greek, for instance. The Una Sancta as official religion at a different time, when the struggles of the Middle Ages were marked by the ascendancy of the papacy or the empire. The doctrine of two swords, who was going to be on top in that. Or at the Reformation Renaissance period of freedom of the gospel and the end of the Una Sancta, the end of that Christendom period, followed immediately by the world of the changing world of exploration and world discovery, and what all of that did at the time of the Reformation. Followed almost immediately in the 17th and 18th centuries, 18th and 19th centuries by the Industrial Revolution and colonialism that followed that whole trend. And then from 1900 on, of an amazing acceleration of change. In the memory of living people, the world has changed from the world of Julius Caesar to something else, because the world of 1900 resembled much more the world of Julius Caesar than it does today. The velocity of change, and in a brief period of 12 years, we saw three revolutions, all of them stemming from our technological power in this country. Partly borrowed, but all Northern European, Western technology. In the first place, the nuclear revolution, 1945, you all know what that is. That was the Hiroshima business. The world has changed. Everything has changed, Einstein said about that, except our way of thinking. We haven't changed the way of thinking yet. It is as though this whole business with atomic weapons is a battle of snowballs. Who's got the most snowballs can win the battle. That's thinking absolutely wrong about that kind of weapon. Second one is a cybernetic revolution. When you think about the presidential election, you remember the primitive computers that they were using to forecast the outcomes of elections back there in the Stevenson-Eisenhower race. That computer that can do all sorts of things. Now, the cybernetic revolution, that automatic guidance. Cybernetic comes from the word steersman in Greek. It's the K in Phi Beta Kappa, steersman. And it has to do with the communications revolution, the fact that we live in a world of communication. And in 1957, here's the other point, in that period of time we entered the space age, the first Sputnik went up in 57. Look at how far we've come in that period of time. A whole new thing has happened to our world. We've got a picture of our globe taken from out there. We can see what our world looks like. You don't have to speculate about that anymore. Okay. I'd like to show you a couple of diagrams now that I prepared to say something quickly about the religions we want to look at. Just as contrast. You probably can't see it on the other side of the hood, can you? Well, still can't see it. Can't see the bottom. So I'll read it. Religion arises from a fear of the unknown, speculation about the unknown, quest for the meaning of life, the conviction that there must be a purpose in life. This is another definition of religion. So concentrating mostly on the source of that religious motivation, that religious feeling. Talking about control or appeasement as offerings to idols, for instance. The fear of the unknown, or speculation about the unknown, and the acknowledgement of mystery, the acknowledgement and maybe even of awe of what is numinous, that sense of the holy. People are convinced that we are not alone, that there is something else, there is some other. Or a quest for the meaning of life. This is to say that it's religion that steers us toward whatever possible meaning there might be. On the conviction that there surely is some purpose to be found. Quite contrary to existentialist philosophers who believe that all is a matter of folly, chance, absurdity. The old religions and one of them that can be mentioned here. The old religions are a worship of nature, the sacred tree, the sacred mountain, the sacred rock, that untouchable precinct, that space where the spirit or the other dwelt, and which was blasted by the great Norwegian St. Olaf when he cut the tree down, the sacred tree down, nothing happened. The world didn't fall in when the sacred tree fell. Now, I don't know whether that's all legend or what, but that's an illustration of a worship of the world of nature. That kind of worship that finds its that finds spirits and spiritualities in everything. The other one is a worship of human power, the worship of an institution that embodies, that represents all of the people, the pharaoh in Egypt, the institution of the monarchy, the divine right of kings, you've heard that one. The worship of the modern state. Now we're getting close to civil religion, you see. The idolatry that rests in the worship of human power in, as Toynbee puts it, in the plural, thank you. The worship of ourselves in plural in the shape of collective human power. So that when we pick out our own idolatries, we pick out our own gods here. And everybody has a theology and everybody worships something. So if it happens to be an expression of human power, watch out. It's one of these old expressions of religion. Different from the transcendent religions, which are the living religions of the world, in which there is a worship of a superior being or force in opposition to or in contrast to a worship, say, of humankind or a worship of nature, pantheism, finding God in everything. And the transcendent religions are revealed religions and philosophical or ethical religions. And we'll say something more about that. This is very, very quick. This is very, very crude. But it's an attempt to say to you that when you look at the Levantine, all of our world religions are Asian. The holy places for the Levantine are Jerusalem, Arabia, and spread from there. The speculative, the Far Eastern religions come from India, and not very far apart. The sources are not very far apart in India. It's a matter of less than a couple hundred miles. Going from the oldest to the youngest, Israel, Christianity, Islam. Going from the oldest to the youngest, Hinduism and Buddhism in the East. You probably can see there the holy places. Something about the dates. The Christian religion being missionary. Well, the characteristic of these three is that they are this worldly, they are prophetic. The prophets speak for God. The prophets speak back to God, as we've been hearing. They are monotheistic. They believe in one God, Allah, Yahweh, and the Trinity. They are ethical religions. That means they're activists. They're trying to do something about this world. They are world-affirming, not world-denying. And they tend to be missionary for the greatest part. Even Israel has as its calling that light to lighten the Gentiles in order that the world may come to Mount Zion. Holy Scriptures are over there. And you'd recognize all of that, I'm sure, the Quran for Islam. In Hinduism, you find an old religion from Benares and the Ganges River. You've seen these exotic pictures from India, I'm sure. Buddhism, founder was Gautama, 560 to 480 BC. It's the youngest one. The spread of Hinduism Buddhism took two paths. It's a reform movement of Hinduism, and one went north to China, Korea. The other one went southeast toward Ceylon from India, toward Ceylon and the Malay Peninsula. In the case of Christianity and Islam, you know, it rose here in Jerusalem, spread toward Rome, through the Mediterranean world, toward Africa, toward India, and the Mar Thoma Church in India, and northward into Russia, and expanded so that now the place that you find Christianity most has been in the Western world, although that's changing. We can't really do justice to all of this because when you begin to talk this way, you really should put in here a whole chapter on the missionary movement, what's happened and what's happened to Christian missions. It would be much easier for us to understand our own background if we could understand that we are really not the ones who originated Christianity or the proprietors of it. They're Easterners. Well, I put down some commonalities over there and some differences. Commonalities of all of these religions is that they have some sense of power. There are some holy places, some sacred precincts, some sacred symbols, some kind of liturgy, some holy writings. They all have temples or something like that as places of worship where people gather. You'll find that there is a commonality in the idea, the general idea expressed in the term the Golden Rule, and they all have some heroes, like David. But there are some differences, and we need to look at those differences seriously, probably later on. They differ on the idea of sin and evil. They differ in ideas of surrounding salvation, or priesthood, or what that meaning of divinity is. Now it's 7:45, I hope, not later than that. That doesn't give us much time. I apologize. I went longer than I thought on that first part, but let's. You're talking about the handling of religion and religious items in popular media,
yes,
mass media.
Yes, that's what we're saying. Yeah. Also, the economic reports as well, not just faith problems.
But there are lots. When you consider the number of reporters, specialists, who report to you on economic news, on television, and economic writers, and realize that there isn't in the network a single person who's covering religion. Some of the major newspapers, Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, and so on, have one or two religion writers. The New York Times used to have a couple. Some of them are even Lutherans. Chuck Austin is a Lutheran writer for the New York Times. It gives you an idea that there isn't very much depth, and what that says is that our propensity is not to pay that much attention to religion because there are other things that are much more urgent. See? And then you put that together with idolatry, you know, ask where the locus of our worship really is, you've found out something that's kind of important for Christians to know. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say now, tonight, is that you got it right, Harry. What we believe and how we understand religion affects the world. That's true. Tomorrow, what I'd like to do is to remind you that you can read religion in pictures because there is the whole Christian body that is very simple for us to learn to look at. And I want to show some representative slides from these world religions on Thursday night. We'll give you, I hope, the idea that you can look at the monuments of other religions and read something from them about the meaning. I think that the significance of all of this to the world, I've said about as much as I can say, I think, tonight, on what that might mean for us. Trying urgently to say we'd better pay attention and we'd better learn, we'd better watch it. Comment here and then.
Well,
same thing could be said, I guess, of when you mentioned this, the worldviews in conflict. The guy who was on Nova on public television, scientist,
Sagan,
whose religious comments are just made in the course of his statements, as though these things are true. Of course, such and such a statement is true, and it's a profoundly religious comment, except it's just dismissed like that because, of course, it's of no consequence. And watching on television, you see, because the public entertainment medium, Christians can see it go by and never catch the sense of what's just been said to them. One of my major pleas, I guess, having to do with the only agenda I have is that in my whole career and everything else is that the church somehow find a renewal to be able to address this world significantly, is a plea to Christians to think, to become informed and think. That whole critical awareness strand in Lutheran doctrine ought to stimulate us, really, to be much more aware of what it is that's going on in the world, much more perceptive about what these things mean to the Christian faith. We're never going to do it with zeal unless our wits are sharper than they are. What time do you have now, Harry? We have to be sure that...
5 minutes, about 53.
We have 53. Yes, please. Take another 2 or 3 minutes.
In your mind, how long do you think that we can go on in the Christian church, not speaking particularly of Lutheran faith, that we feel that we can turn out pastors in 3 years?
How long can we go on preparing pastors in as short a time as 3 years? Is that your question?
As short a time as 3 years, 1 year, your internship. To me, it is just absolutely beyond anything that I can imagine that our seminaries could do, or for that matter, you know, really prepare for the things that are facing them because of the tremendous changes that are before us. You can't even touch the hem of the garment on any of these things, you know, that are being spoken of.
There's three comments. First is, I don't know. Seminaries do seminary-type things. They change very slowly. Second, I work in two different fields, both of which I think are very important to seminary education. And in both cases, it's been very hard to reach to seminary education to do very much in terms of social ministries, those things which express the Christian faith in action, acted evangelism, if you will, especially as it affects public policy in our country. The second one is communication. Everybody seems to know that we live in a communication world, and the most communication that you find in Lutheran seminaries these days is homiletics, and that's not always a predominant subject anyway for mastery. But I don't know. I suspect that seminaries will go on this way and change slowly. They're very reluctant to add more time, I think. Who's in touch with seminary education?
I talked to one seminary professor just very recently, and he confided, I assume it was in confidence, that could have mentioned his name or what seminary he's from. But he said that he felt that, in at least one seminary that he was acquainted, but he felt it was generally and possibly a very small percentage of the seminary professors, and that's not to put them down, were actually qualified to be in charge of the congregation. It's a far out of touch, you know, once you've been in the Ivory Tower for 3 years.
But there's a reason for that. There's a reason.
You just don't know what's going on in the congregation.
But there's a reason for a lot of that, and the reason has to do with a lot of the work the rest of us do. If this is a shape of human knowledge, we live in a world that has seen that knowledge expand. I was talking about the three revolutions that have taken place in 12 years' time. That knowledge is expanding and expanding and expanding. We're like dogs in the library. We're surrounded by knowledge we don't even know exists. And part of it is perishing. And part of it is deteriorating all the time. The professor at Michigan State said to his engineering students, half of what I teach you now will not be operable in 10 years' time. My problem is I can't tell you which half. You see? But in order to handle this vast stuff, what we've done is to divide it up into specialties like this. You see? And this has very little relationship to this. And these are specialized boxes. And seminary professors have their specialties. And if they're going to be any good to anybody, they really got to be sharp in Old Testament. They might know some things on both sides, but that's what they've got to give. It's this whole specialization. And that's true of almost any field of human work. We have had to divide and make specialties out of, and they get narrower and narrower and narrower. And medical fields and technical fields are getting narrower and narrower still. Great rapidity. And this makes it hard for people to talk to each other. Well, anyway, it says something about the reason that a person who is an Old Testament scholar is reluctant to have anything taken out of the seminary curriculum that has to do with the Old Testament because it's so all-fired important.
Well, I meant to, I probably misunderstood that. I meant to be critical, you know, of the good work that these men are trying to do.
No.
But the thing is this, they're in an awful dilemma.
Yes, oh yes.
I asked one man who's an academic dean at one time, and he said, well, our big dilemma is half the people who come, he says, have so many personal problems.
Well, that's true, too.
And many of them are second career people, and that's not meant as a criticism either. He said, we don't know where we're at. And then I said to him, and I said, and then after you've been in the tower, you know, ivory tower, you know, for so many years, he said, yeah, we don't know what the cutting edge is about. You know, in other words, he meant to say he didn't say it. But I assumed he meant to be honest with me and said, look, fella, we're aiming at nothing and hitting. You kind of said you really didn't know what to aim.
I would venture a guess that not very much is going to happen to change seminary education until after 1988. And that the reason for choosing that date is that there will be a new Lutheran church and there will perhaps be some kind of shakeup. And typical of this, I lived through the Lutheran mergers in 60 and 63, and the typical issue in servanthood in those days was, well, you can't decide it now because it's foolish because a new church will make some changes, and then for two or three years after the new church, you're so busy getting things in order so that things can function that you've almost frozen activity for about 4 or 5 or 6 years. Well, friends, that's the bell for Vespers.